From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Shivick's cat can be a jerk. Demanding, selfish, sanctimonious. But he loves him. Because he's not just a cat, not just a pet. Pinguino, that's his name, is a unique individual who has an inner life, who does lots of cat things, but some not-so-cat-like things. In other words, he's different. And if you have a pet, all of this makes complete sense and doesn't really even sound all that remarkable. But John Shivick is also a scientist, a biologist. And this idea that animals have emotional lives is still controversial in the scientific community. But in a new book, Shivick says that's changing. And so he draws on research to make his case that animals have individual personalities. And he also asks, why do they? Join us after the news.
On the next More to Say, the price of textbooks. It's not uncommon to pay over $100 for a science or math textbook, and new editions are frequently published. For students struggling to pay for higher education, a pricey textbook can mean the difference between going to class or dropping out. KUER's Lee Hale has been looking into the problem. Download the next episode of More to Say wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you have a pet now or ever did, it's pretty easy to make the case that animals have inner lives, that they have emotions and personalities. Darwin thought this. He even made a case for it. But that was one of his theories that didn't stick. In fact, for decades and decades, scientists and researchers have been incredibly skeptical of this idea. It was all sentimental anthropomorphizing as far as they were concerned. But John Shivick says that is starting to change. More and more biologists like him are starting to look into the inner lives of animals. And in his new book, he examines the research to explore what animal individuality means to humans and our relationship with them. His book is called Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. John Shivick is a biologist who's worked as a federal researcher and wildlife manager, as a state predator biologist. He's also the author of the book, The Predator Paradox, and he's back with us in the studio to talk about his latest. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about Pinguino.
Must we?
We must. This is your cat who is, for all practical purposes, an a-hole. That's the first line. I cleaned that up just a little bit. Talk a little bit about your cat. I mean, this is a good way sort of into this conversation. Kind of a burden, but he's yours. And, you know, what are you going to do? You like him because of his personality. I think this is a good way into this conversation. Let's talk about your cat.
Okay. Oh, I think I have to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. In his defense, I'm not a cat person.
Yeah.
You know, never had been. It seems like there's cat people and dog people and... oh, I've got the dogs that I've loved and bonded with and did all these training and tricks and all these kinds of wonderful things. And cats, you don't do that with.
Yeah.
Not so much. But, you know, there's something about this particular cat versus the other cats I've also been around, a real strength of personality. Yeah. And if there's been one wake-up moment through all this, thinking about animal personalities, is this jerk jumping up into my crotch at night and meowing loudly. You know, that's the, you can't ignore that.
Yeah.
You just can't ignore that.
You say up front in the book, you know, wow, individual animals express themselves, duh.
Yeah.
Like I said in the introduction, I mean, if you have an animal, you know this, but your purpose, as I said in the introduction there, and I want to get you to explain what you mean, is to explore what these personalities mean to humans. You're not focused just on humans. Human exceptionalism is part of the problem here,
right.
but that is part of this, right? Is our relationship with animals.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. The other launching point is that everybody that's had a pet, they've been around animals, they know those animals and they know there's emotions there. You know, we have the same similar physiology. We know there's emotions. We know there's personality. So in some ways, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's the book about? What's the whole concept about? Well, the concept is that it's bigger than that. It's something science has been ignoring, largely because of this feelings of squishiness, this anthropomorphizing and not wanting to do that. And there's a whole lot of baby in the argument that and a lot less bathwater. So I've been really excited to see how now the argument's more about, whoa, there's something going on here. And this individual variation in animals is a bigger deal. It's not just this cutesy, well, my cat does this or my cat does that. It's really important ecologically and scientifically.
But also it seems socially. Because it seems like one of the arguments you're making is that there's a kind of biological morality in the way we bond with creatures and the way we interact with creatures.
You really cut to the chase.
Yeah.
This is where as I've developed these ideas, this is something I learned as I was developing these ideas and really helped me kind of figure out my place in the world and how biology works. I think the fundamental tension of biology is evolution. Natural selection needs individual variation. If you're going to have resilience in a species, you've got to have variability. So as conditions change, the species can adapt. The flip side of it is we do better when we cooperate.
Yeah.
We do better when we form groups. Whether you're a single cell grouping together with other cells, becoming a whole organism, becoming a tribe, becoming a society, you do better.
Yeah.
The problem is there's a tension there. And the more individual you are, the less able you are in some ways to interact in a uniform way with the rest of society.
Yep.
So that tension happens within societies.
Yep.
You see it all over the place now. And then it also happens between species, you know, between continents, within species, and within all sorts of species. So I think it's a really fascinating area of research that we need to get into that has immediate relevance socially.
Well, we'll get back to this, but like my basic question about that is, why would nature select for that? Wouldn't nature want just a bunch of automatons who acted in the same way so we can be successful in that way?
But the converse happens.
Yeah.
Because nature changes. And you're right. Actually, for any given time, any given moment, that's what natural selection's doing, or any given yesterday, really.
Yeah.
So we're being honed based on those conditions that we grew up in or evolved in. But nature's always changing in front of us. So what happens to species that, and there's evidence of it, species that become too specific, they're super efficient. They're super good at what they do. But if conditions change, they go extinct.
Yeah.
So there's this real interplay with keeping variability in the system, but being as efficient as you can possibly be. It's a great optimization problem. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it gets to this kind of, as you said, it's kind of squishy idea of, hey, difference is good. Well,
yes.
It turns out biologically, difference is good.
Can you imagine how much better I felt when, you know, after all these years of sensitivity training and diversity training, and you know, it's right, but diversity is good because, well, you know, it's rainbows, unicorns, and that kind of thing. But actually, biologically, diversity is good.
Yeah.
It's really important. If conditions change, I can think of it this way. If we think about, you know, in military point of view. I grew up as a Navy dependent, and so I've been around the military a lot. So there's one really efficient way to make a military, and everybody does the same thing. They all lockstep, they march, they do all these other kinds of things. But what are we seeing these days as conditions have changed? It's not necessarily the big armies. Mm-hmm. It's these little flexible Navy SEAL groups that are all about individual variation, adaptability for any particular situation. So something that's monolithic and uniform is good in some situations, but it can't change fast enough for conditions, whereas something with a lot more variation and variability changes fast.
Yeah.
And so that's what nature's doing, the same thing on the species level. Nature's saying, hey, you got to be the better than the next animal over, but at the same time, you need to have enough variation that when we change the switch on you,
we survive.
You survive, yeah.
So what was it like as a biologist, as a scientist, is trying to be dispassionate about the research, to come up with concepts that are related to cooperation and bonding and love? Like, was that difficult?
I'm kind of a person too, Doug.
Yeah, I know you are. I know you are. But isn't that part of the point, is that scientists have had a hard time with that side of the equation, it seems.
Well, no, and you're exactly right. And that was embracing it. And that's where Pinguino helps. That's where the other bonds with other animals, with other people that have really helped. I think I was trained in a really normal way for the time, back in undergraduate wildlife management major. And it was all about getting rid of anthropomorphism. Is this Morgan's Cannon idea, this reaction that if you can't see it, then you shouldn't infer that it's there.
I want you to explain Morgan's Cannon, because I mentioned Darwin, right?
Mm-hmm.
How Darwin believed that animals had inner states and had emotions. But this was one of the things that never stuck for him, as I said.
Right.
You point this out in the book. Then came this idea of this British psychologist and ethnologist, C. Lloyd Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And he creates this, as you say, this canon, this catechism for scientists.
Exactly.
Basically, he applied Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest answer is the best answer. And he figured that believing animals don't really have internal emotions is just the simplest answer.
Mm-hmm.
And it stuck. And here's the catechism. In no case may we interpret an action as the outcome of the exercise of a higher physical faculty.
Right?
And so that was your upbringing in science.
Exactly.
This idea that, don't think they're cute and have nice personalities. They just want to have sex and just want to get fed and just want to survive.
It was even more than that, though, is it turns everything into a clock mechanism.
Hmm.
And it says if you can't do it with gears and nuts and bolts, speaking somewhat metaphorically here, but if you can't really describe the science that way, then don't. And what was tragic, and let me tell you a little bit about the way this evolved too. It's interesting because what Darwin said, Darwin looked at physiology, and he looked at how humans feel things, and he looked at how other animals had the same neurons, brains, this kind of thing. And it's actually a pretty natural inference to say, if we have the same physiologies, it's pretty natural to see that we might feel the same way, have emotions, those kinds of things. But then as other scientists went with that, then it became to, then earthworms could feel shame or whatever.
Yeah.
And then
and
people started thinking, And then that got to be in Victorian England.
Yeah.
Then I think it was more of a backlash. And it became, no, the simplest answer. Use the simplest answer. And the irony is the simplest answer actually is what Darwin was saying, which is we have similar physiologies. We probably feel the same. But that got thrown out.
See, I can't figure out why it got thrown out, why it became such a dogma. And part of me thinks, or wonders anyway, early on, you mentioned the Victorian age, and I'm wondering if this kind of haughty hubris of humans was part of it. I'm wondering what religion may have played in it too, at least early on.
I don't want to go and blame religion or church or whatever, because there is within humans this desire to set ourselves apart no matter what.
It's not a religious inclination.
No,
it
might be.
I think
I can't tell if religion adopted that or, or the other way around.
Spoken like a good biologist.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. And whether it's something like, I grew up, nothing uses tools but humans. Okay, well, then chimpanzees. Well, then there's these dolphins that do this cool thing with sponges. Okay, then we keep on finding every place we look.
Lateralization. New Caledonian. It's only humans
exactly.
are left-handed. But
right.
Turns out elk are left-handed
and
right-handed.
Right. And so we just slam the door on – and again, you can go too far with anthropomorphizing.
Sure.
I don't want to go and say – I can infer my dog's going through these, has emotions and feels things, but it's really difficult to go and say, he feels exactly this or exactly that or exactly that. So we have to have a limit to it.
Of course.
But we just don't want to slam the door and say, it's only humans that do this stuff and animals don't.
And I think the idea of being resistant to animal emotions appealed to scientists in part because it stopped anecdotal thinking.
Yes. So that was a good side of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So it made sense on some level. And you were pretty dogmatic.
Absolutely.
A pretty haughty, I think, is the word you used.
Oh, arrogant. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Maybe a little still. I don't know. But yeah, definitely. No, you get trained that way. And then when you hear people speak in ways that they attribute human emotions to animals, and you've been trained to think, no, that doesn't happen, it becomes part of, maybe that became, you know, part of my religion at the point.
Yeah.
And the easiest way to deal with that is to dismiss that as, oh, those are blurry sentimentalists. I'm a scientist, dang it. Well, you know, maybe I've learned a little as I've experienced life.
Yeah. The book, of course, uses research, and we'll get into some of those. But you also use stories from your own life with animal companions, mm-hmm. your chickens, yeah. your of course, your annoying cat and yeah. your wonderful dogs, uh-huh. Gretchen in particular, yeah. mm-hmm. Which we'll come back to. It's kind of personal. Mm-hmm. Did that give you pause, that doing it in a personal way might, I don't know, annoy some of your scientist academic colleagues? Do you know what I mean?
Hmm. I never thought about it that way. I thought I was being objectively subjective. You know, it's really about people and emotion and bonding and where we get to in the end of the narrative is, why is personality important? Personality isn't important just because, wow, gee whiz, animals have it.
Yep.
Personality is important because it says something, or it is the mechanism by which we get along with each other.
Yeah.
And the easiest way for me to describe that at that deeper level, frankly, is to bring in some of those personal anecdotes,
right.
and kind of walk people through it. Because I didn't learn anything from, I didn't get to this idea of personality by reading papers on animals. I got this idea of personality by working with individual animals, whether they're wild coyotes or Gretchen, you know,
yeah.
through my life.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to your experience with the coyotes here in a moment. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting is you say, okay, so dogma was holding up scientists for a while, mm-hmm. from looking in the inner lives of animals.
Right.
But part of it was also this lack of science. You say, now we're coming to a deeper scientific understanding about all of this. And so all of these, it seems like all of these new insights are coming to people.
We didn't even have the language. So interestingly, at the same time we're developing some of these ideas, is this is when statistics started to happen. We started to find mathematical ways to describe the world. And we got past this idea of anecdotes because now we had this new tool. But the fundamental thing about a lot of the way our statistics work, you're looking at averages. You're looking at mathematical means. And you're comparing a mean of this population to a mean of this population. And it means that we're looking for things to measure.
Yeah.
Well, tail length's easy to measure, height's easy to measure, those kinds of things. So we started measuring those things. Then we started to push them into what the average of this population is. And all of a sudden, we're comparing two averages, and the variation is noise in the system. So the other part of my career was trying to get rid of the noise in the system. So yeah. we were looking at the main effect, realizing only lately that the noise is actually the important part.
Right. That sameness doesn't drive nature, differences do.
Exactly. Yeah. Well said.
I quoted you.
Oh, thank you.
John Shivick is with us. His book is Mousy Cats and Sheep as Coyotes. I want to say it like you do, coyotes.
You can say it whichever
way. Okay, I don't know. I said coyotes earlier. Mm-hmm. I'll go back and forth. Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KZR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the inner lives of animals. The idea that they have emotions, which seems obvious to a lot of us, but as you probably know, scientists have been wary of this idea for some time. The Utah biologist John Shivick says, the more we're learning, though, about animals, the more it's clear they have unique personalities, and he explains what all of this means. His book is Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. He's just joining us in the studio to talk about it. When did you first start entertaining the idea? I think you said in some ways it was because you were having these experiences with animals. Maybe it was coyotes in particular that gave you this insight that they're not all the same. They're incredibly different.
So some of my earlier studies, I specialized in working with predators, wolves, bears, coyotes, those kinds of things, largely with coyotes. And I'd have to capture them, put radio collars on them, track them around, do those kind of collar and follow wildlife biology experiments. which meant I'd have to set traps, bait, you know, lures, try different things. And coyotes are fascinating because sometimes you'll go and pick up one the next day. Another one will go sniff, dig, flip it over, pee on it, and leave you that.
Yeah.
Then I think a real world experience was, oh gosh, usually coyotes are pretty easy to handle. I capture them, muzzle them, pull them out of the trap, do all the measurements, put a collar on them, and they run, and then let them go, yeah. And they run away.
And they'll realize I'm caught. I'm just going to.
Yeah, they just give up. They're just kind of submissive. This is the big dog. Until one day.
Yeah, you met one.
One that was quite the opposite.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, say he must have been, you know, he was 400 pounds. He was big, gnarly. He was a normal coyote.
Yeah.
But he came up and he didn't shy away. He didn't do any of those things. He looked at me, stared me in the eye, and then as I was handling him, got away and bit me in the thigh.
Yeah.
So there's an eye opener. It's like, wait, this one's different than the others.
You say in the book that this experience was a defining moment of your life.
I would think it was. Yeah. Yeah. Getting bitten up in the upper thigh will get your attention quickly. But I handled him. I let him go. And I had this immense amount of respect for this animal. And it started the wheels turning. It's like, well, how come some of these are different? How come some of these are not? And then as I did more research on them, and I was trying to figure out non-lethal ways to manage predation, to keep them from eating sheep, for instance.
Yep.
And some of them, we'd go and string up some scare device or put some scare device out there. And some of them are just afraid. They run away. They do what they're supposed to do. And other ones are really bold. They don't care. And they go right through it. And then it starts to sink in. Not only is there individual variation, is there personality, what becomes important is, wow, this variability, this personality is what's thwarting my ability to manage these animals.
It's how they're surviving.
Yeah. But it also, for me as a wildlife manager, I'm thinking practically, I can't just outsmart one coyote. I got to outsmart all of them, which means there is no one solution. There's no one size fits all, which means our science has to be less about just an average and more about the variability.
Yeah. There's a scientist named Laurie Schmidt that you write about in the book. Who helped you? You say interviewing her helped you understand this transformation that you were undergoing. And it was related to her study of wolves. Talk about this, if you would.
So Laurie's at the Wolf Center. And what I think, if anything, the conversation with her might have been one of those affirmation things. You know, what she was in her conversation was very down to earth. And it was a scientist talking to a scientist. And a scientist saying, some wolves are different than other wolves.
Yeah.
Out of this 25 or so that she's dealt with, there's only two or three that stand out. And there are certain things about their personality, this real ability of these animals to be, I wasn't bold, but more confident, that led to trust. And trust between her and that animal. So all of a sudden, I've got three lessons in a 10-minute, you know, conversation of, okay, here's a biologist noticing that animals are different. Here's a biologist acknowledging of those different ones, there's something that allows a two-way communication that builds to trust, which is a relationship. And she just kind of wrote the book for me. Right.
Totally. I mean, because that is the essence of your book.
Yeah.
Right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It must have been reassuring to talk to a scientist who was on the same page.
Absolutely. No, it was very reassuring. Very reassuring. And what was great, I mean, she also came up with the notion too, she's a great teacher and would explain that it's important just to lay the facts. You know, I'm not trying to proselytize. I'm not trying to be cutesy in this or whatever. But what we can do is we can go through everything from coyotes to wolves to bears to spiders to striders to, you know, to crabs. And you see the same trends happening. And it should allow people to put two and two together and say, wow, not only is this out there, but this is important. This isn't John just being cute. You know, this is real stuff.
Seems like the hardest part or one of them was overcoming what you describe as your own covert bias, that bias of perception. This is difficult because we have our own sensory world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to imagine the world of another creature Talk about that, because this seemed like an obstacle you had to get over. Perception bias,
and it's not just me; it's us.
Yeah,
we're humans. We're in our bubbles, our perceptual bubbles. You know, we only see the world based on the way our senses are tuned.
Yeah,
and we know this as humans. We ignore it, but we are really visual. And I talk about this as a mirror test. I'd love to try to. There's this thing that we use again as humans to show how we're different, how clever we are, that we can identify ourselves.
Put an animal in front of a mirror.
Yeah, you put an animal in front of a mirror, and a lot of them just kind of attack it. They think it's some other animal or whatever. Or you can take an elephant and put a dot on its head, and then it'll take its trunk and look in the mirror and say, "Whoa, that's me. That dot on what's that dot there from?" But other animals won't.
Yeah.
But if you get something like a dog, there can be visual, but to them, the olfactory world is everything. So imagine seeing the world through your nose, the way you see it through your eyes. And that's a dog's world. When they're out on a walk and they'll sniff where something peed 3 days before, they probably know who that dog is, how old that dog is, male, female, how long ago it was. I call it pee male or nose book, you know. So they're going through and they're getting so much information. And inadvertently, just because we don't have those sensors, we miss a huge part of the way to look at the world. And that's part of the reason why we're mistranslating something.
I loved that part of the book where because a dopey dog can't see himself in a mirror, we figure they're stupid.
Funny, huh?
But that's not – but they have a complex relationship with the world. It's just in a different sense. It's
absolutely
their nose.
Yeah. It's just their nose. You know what the amazing thing about them? They can still take all that information and still find ways to interact and bond with us.
So in that sense, they're kind of better than we are.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of ways. Definitely some dogs and some people.
It's true. Mm. So quantifying what is personality is one of the things you write about. There's this 1996 paper on Rhesus monkeys that you write about, which you describe in the book as kind of science's first step towards accepting animal personality.
They never even use the word. They're always behavioral tendency.
It's
temperament. It's something else. We were always trying to come up with.
There's
your first clue.
They buried it in the middle of the report somewhere.
Exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You want to say something about this study? I think this was interesting because it measured an individual's response.
I think it's just one of those series of stepwise occurrences. And it also shows how they're avoiding things like personality. But then the more you look at it, you measure these animals when they're young, and then you measure them 30 years later, and you find out there's certain things that remain the same. And then it starts sinking in. It's like, wait a minute. These things are not just stimulus response, stimulus response, stimulus response. There's certain consistencies in them. But then when you flip that against, for instance, some of the dolphin papers, pre-Katrina, post-Katrina. The storm. We can see the same things where you see these animals that they go out, they measure them, you measure for temperament, you find certain animals have a certain temperament, then you measure after this huge traumatic event, and you see the animals still line up in mostly the same way, except for one. And this one takes a turn for the worse.
Yeah.
And this is another reason why this kind of research is going to be relevant for humans as well, because you put a bunch of animals through a really traumatic experience and some just turn out the other end fine. Other ones turn out with post-traumatic stress. And you can see this in dolphins and you can see this in elephants and certainly you can see this in people too. And I think it's really useful to say, whoa, what is it that's different about that person or that porpoise or that elephant or whatever? You know, what's going to make them susceptible to this or not susceptible to that? And those early papers just kind of hinted us along. You know, you couldn't really come out and say it. Now it's more okay to say and actually more okay to study in itself.
How do you measure, this is how you put it, the plastic dynamic trend that is personality? I mean, how do we come up with a metric that – how does a scientist come up with a metric? I don't feel like I need one. I can look at my dog and say, oh, he's really afraid right now. But it seems like it's hard to agree on these metrics. And for humans, we have like the Myers-Briggs test, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. gives us a sense of someone's more aggressive or they tend to be an extrovert or right. whatever the thing is. Are animals the same? Do
yes.
they fall along those same continuum?
Yes, but they're easier and harder to measure. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you have the Justice Stewart method of evaluation.
Kind of,
I don't
right?
know what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the difficulty, if we're going to make this scientific, we have to be beyond the anecdote. We have to measure something.
Right.
And here's a funny irony is that we're trying to measure how everything is different in a lot of ways. So by identifying personality, you need to have some metrics to still categorize, to still group things. And it can be things like bold. It can be things like shy. I could be something that's a bold adventurer or more the homebody. And there's different ways this stuff manifests itself in ecologically. But we have to figure out ways to measure it. And that is something that's quite difficult to do. And then you have to also account for... There's variation on a daily basis. There's moods. I could have got up this morning if I had come in and I hadn't eaten and I had stubbed my toe. This could have been a very different conversation than, you know, coming in happy.
Right.
So we have these sideboards of even though there's variance between individuals, there's also variance within individual, but personality means there's consistency within every individual. So you're going to vary every day depending on your mood, but you've got these sidebars. Somebody that's always somebody that's a jerk all the time is always a jerk.
Yep.
Somebody that's usually a nice person can be a jerk. But you have to play with you have to acknowledge where they are in that continuum.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by that plasticity.
Yeah, well, and in that sense it's no different from us.
No.
It's just harder to measure because we can fill out the questionnaire.
I know, but people lie.
That's true.
There's that too. And yeah. and so that's not all of a sudden, here's the answer.
Yeah.
You still have to do some observation and interpret it in a way that's useful. With animals, we can put a bird in a novel environment. We can see how much it flutters to novel objects. But then we have to measure that. Well, was it hungry or was it not hungry? Or was it is it old? Is it young? Is it what are the other motivating factors out there to try to make sense of it? So that's why this science is so cool to me right now. It's like we're just figuring those things out.
Yeah.
We know to ask those questions now. We know to separate what is bold in the context of hunger or bold in the context of sexual relations or bold in the context of dispersal.
Right.
Dispersal. But now we know to ask the question. So,
and now you have the freedom to be able to ask it.
And you have the freedom to be able to. So the
yeah.
cool thing's not now.
Yeah.
It's what's going to happen 10 years from now.
Yeah.
That's what
I
can't wait to see that book.
I want to ask about a desert tortoise named Rose.
Aw.
Because what I loved about this story is... A part of this is the way you're talking about how evolution favors a variety of personalities within different species.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the idea that a desert tortoise, which seems just like this lumpen thing sometimes, they have personality. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think a lot of the point there is if we're paying attention, we'll see things. That aspect. The other is... Oh, boy, if I talk about animal personality, people will come with, oh, my dog or my cat or my horse. What I found—
All the big mammals.
All the big mammals. Or then they'll say, okay, maybe apes, maybe chimpanzees, sure, that kind of thing. The point there, the lesson there was Denise has this, it's a desert tortoise.
Yeah. There's a researcher named Denise Chang.
She's a friend up in Logan, actually.
Okay.
So she adopted a desert tortoise, you can do through Utah, and the Division of Wildlife Resources. But the real story was showing how some animals, it's just a tortoise, but there's some that are obnoxious, and they're bold, and they're feisty, and they're fighters. And then here's Rose, who's this loving, pays attention to them. And it's just a way to hook us in, is open our eyes. It's not just about dogs and horses and that kind of thing. It's about reptiles, for crying out. They're tortoise. This is an order that developed a long, long time ago. And if it's in these brains, then it's everywhere.
Yeah. You say in the book, having a winning personality is as important as an animal's physiology. Is that true?
Well, that's right.
In terms of the way it is successful?
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems like a remarkable thing to say. I love it.
No, my mom always told me that. Yeah, no, it's that's the thing that's important. So I think we've highlighted on measuring the things that are easy.
Yeah.
So you can take bluebirds, you can measure the bluebird tails and see the ones that are longer and assume, oh, they're going to fly better, or they're going to fly better in this situation, that situation. Or you can take the another examples of crabs, crabs on the beach, and there's some that are they're more wary relative to predation, and they know to go hide and hide the right amount of time. And but at the same time, these crabs have these huge claws, and they wave the claws to attract females into their den. And what do we do as our, you know, prurient biologists that we are? Well, oh, it must be this guy waving his big claw around. That's what's going to – the females are going to like that. And as it turns out, no, it's not that. It's more – what the correlation between the attractiveness of the male was not the – this is –
the big thing.
Radio. Yes, exactly. Yeah, be careful, I guess, what I'm saying. Yeah. It's not them waving this big thing out there. It's more that personality that attracts her, and that's what she chooses from. And we only knew that from that story because they paid attention enough to measure these other aspects of behavior. Behavior is an evolutionary shortcut. Behavior is really important. We just have been focused on physiology. Behavior is equally as important as physiology.
You know, it's funny. I used to always think that it was the for birds, some tropical birds, it was the color presentation. It was the way they cleaned up their nest and made it presentable for the mate.
Right.
It wasn't just the big thing. It wasn't just the colorful thing. It wasn't just the physiological thing. The fact that there might be, I like your personality.
Yeah.
And that makes me want to mate with you.
Right.
Too. Mm-hmm. That to me was kind of remarkable.
Right. But then there still isn't one type.
Yeah.
And here's where it gets to, this is the unique, and this is where we end up at that uniqueness of bonds between individuals. Bluebirds are a great example. Renee Duckworth, just, oh, I'm such a fan of her. She's just done some amazing research through the years and just followed through these birds, followed through these animals and what they've done. And you have some bluebirds that are the macho, aggressive. They're kicking all the others out. They're the fighters. They're the ones that are not letting other blue. They have all the nest boxes, all the nest holes that they're, you know, they are the macho dudes that are keeping everybody else out.
Right.
Then you have the poor lowly ones, the more meek. And then for any female bluebird, does she want to choose this big macho one that keeps everybody out? Or does she want to keep this other one that sort of seems kind of weak in a lot of ways? Well, as it turns out, since the macho ones are out fighting all the time, they're not home helping her feed the young as much, and they don't reproduce as well. So then the other ones that aren't fighting as much, they're around home more. So there's a strategy within strategy within strategy, and it shows why some females will form one, go one direction, another go another direction, and voila, we've got diversity in the system. That has other ecological things down the line that we can talk about too.
Yeah, but that seems to turn a basic idea almost on its head on some level, that it's not just the strongest thing that contributes to survival, that creatures are thinking of other things.
Yes, exactly.
The nerds can succeed.
Thank goodness. Right? Thank goodness. So we have hope, Doug. We have hope.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. But go on with the bluebird one, if I may. So what happens is you're in different situations and then different strategies will come out. So as the bluebirds have moved into new areas, they will displace other birds. And so the ones that win in that scenario are these aggressive ones, the ones that are fighters. They kick everybody else out. And that way, that allows them that macho ability to invade new lands, essentially. But then after a time of that population being there for quite a while, they're not reproducing as well because they're fighting all the time. So those ones, they're built better to disperse, to go on, to be aggressive, to do great things that way. And then through time, you'll see a shift in the population where you have more of those animals that are better homebodies, better, they don't fight as much, they're better providers. So it depends what you are, where you are, when you are, as to which thing wins. And that just shows you how important that adaptability is, that variance within the population that allows the species to do great things they otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
John Shivick is with us. His book is Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with John Shivick. We're talking about his new book about the science of animal personalities. It's called Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes. There's a story you tell about. I think a lot of people know the story of this Russian fox experiment. It's kind of a famous one. Yes. You use it as in a section where you talk about this question of nature versus nurture and what we're learning about animal personalities are telling us about that interplay between nature and nurture, whether it's genes or whether it's environment.
Mm-hmm. So for behavior, for personality to be important, it means, on an evolutionary scale, it means something that evolution, the natural environment, has to be able to act on. There has to be a genetic, there has to be a heritable component of it. And that's a large basis of my argument, is that what behavior does is allows animals to really fast forward a process by developing the ability to do things that would take millions and millions of years to do otherwise. And they can develop that by being shaped one way or the other in terms of behavior as much as with physiology. It's just that behavior can happen quicker. And a really interesting demonstration of that, of course, is this famous Russian fox experiment where the researchers started selecting for individual animals based on their temperament.
Yeah.
So they'd walk by the cage. If it did the normal fox thing and huddled and backed and tried desperately to get away, they'd go past it. But if it had any semblance of looking at the researcher, interacting with the researcher, doing that kind of a thing, they'd pull it out and be allowed to breed.
So they were basically selecting for their
personality. For personality. Yeah. They're selecting for personality. Yep. Exactly. Yep. So they did that, and it happened pretty quickly that, after 30 generations, 49% of these foxes are acting like puppies. And now, after breeding a good 10,500 foxes and producing 50,000 offspring, most of these sweet little foxes they're puppies. They're floppy-eared. They're white. They're, adorable and very friendly. They're still foxes. They'll still tear into your couch. And yeah. I wouldn't say that they're the best pets necessarily, but their personality is very in line with what humans get along with well.
So what does that tell us, do you think, about the way, because you mentioned this in the book, the way our early human ancestors domesticated dogs? Does that tell us anything?
Well, did we domesticate them or did they domesticate
us? No, I think it's the other way around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a certain element of it, of animals figuring out ways to form bonds with us and us with them. We feed them. We shelter them. And
it's an interplay, isn't it?
It's an interplay. Yeah. So there's a lot of theories on how that initial domestication started. But where it really picked up is when we started forming these strong bonds with them. It's not just working with the dog. It's having the dog up in the cab, yeah. the pickup truck with you, not yeah. just hanging out in the back.
Yeah. You write about how nature embraces and encourages variation. It thrives on difference, right? But then you say, what happens when we reject that preference, nature's preference? And you write about chickens and these huge egg-producing operations, how they created for a time super chickens.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work.
Well, it worked.
It sort of worked.
Sort of worked.
At first.
But it backfired because of, again, and this is the importance of variation behaviorally, and also the importance of, be careful what you ask for. So this was research initially, and then turned into a TED Talk, and it's just kind of a really fun story where researchers early on said, oh, wow, we'll make these super chickens. We'll just take, instead of selecting for a fox that's really nice, I'm going to take the hen that just cranks out the most eggs.
Kills it with eggs.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other one, and the other one, the other one. And so you get these top performer chickens, and if you put all these top performer chickens in a coop and you compare them to just your normal hens lazing about,
they're total jerks.
They're total jerks. They kill each other. Yeah. And instead of having 30 super chickens cranking out two eggs a day, you end up with one chicken cranking out two eggs a day. And then the other group, they get along. They do an egg every other day.
Yep.
But they work out better. So that's a that's an important aspect I think we can learn for business or for, you know, work environments.
Or the way we treat
animals. The way we treat animals, the way we treat people. Yeah, it's there's not going to be this one ideal. There's not this Aryan race that's going to just solve the world's problems. It's more about that diversity and getting along that you're going to do better. Yeah, that's a major take-home message here.
Yeah, cooperation is critical.
Cooperation is as important.
You say scientists tend to focus more on, like looking at bees, for example.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Say something about bees. Like scientists, you said, have focused more on the strife part when they're looking at them rather than the cooperation. And you're saying we need to shift that focus a little bit.
Yeah. I think I talked a lot more about strife, especially with things like mountain lions, where we look at these animals, oh, they're solitary, oh, they don't get along. But then if we have our eyes open and spend enough time out there, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And then when scientists have the ability to go and look at something more depth, they realize, wow. And there's just a paper out really recently regarding social interactions between mountain lions. And it's this thing that's not supposed to happen. But then we look into it, and it does. So this antisocial species can be social too. What's up with that? Then with bees, oh, this was so much fun doing the research for this and delving into it and really pushing the envelope, because bees, I thought bees are they're the Borg, they're the drones,
yeah.
They don't have any personality, they just go out. But hives have personalities, and there's families within hives that have different, essentially, personalities. So there's variability there, even in the thing that I've been taught since the beginning has no variation, has variation. And it's an important variation. Some bees that have this variability, they're able to ward off diseases that other bees can't. So now people that are raising bees, they can select for some hives over other hives based on the capabilities that these different hives have.
The personality of the hive.
I know. How cool is that? It's very cool.
So cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about bonding. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things you write about, is bonding, how it's bonding where we can overcome that tension between the collective and the personal. You write about, like, spider monkeys. They embrace.
Yeah.
It's one of the things
right.
that they do to sort of cool down what mm-hmm. might be the sort of tension in the group. Bonobos, same
yeah,
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do we do something like that, humans?
Oh, gosh. We shake hands.
Yeah.
Hug. Talk. Make eye contact. There's all sorts of subtle things we're constantly doing to take the situation down. Situations can escalate. I didn't. Gosh, you just got me thinking about that. I mean, maybe that's what road rage happens. There's this complete distance between you and this other person that you don't even see as a person. There's zero bond. There's yep. zero communication other than this
big metal
thing.
It's just another can on the road.
It's another can on the road. And because there's no social connection, no eye contact, no smile, no handshake, no holding your hands up, whoa, 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 sorry, it can escalate all sorts of bad places. So we have all these subtle cues we're using all the time. I think now is the time to kind of pay more attention to what these cues are. And not only do we use them between humans, we use them between humans and non-human animals.
I love this research that you write about that was done by a person named Bernhard Fink. And it involved dancing.
Oh, yeah.
It involved movement and how our movement communicates our chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
I love this.
Well, it's tragic and lovable in the same way. So that research they made avatars. The researchers made avatars of men dancing. So they just had a basic drum beat, nothing fancy, and had men dance. And they digitized them into essentially stick figures and then had women rate how they danced. And they're pretty hard on them. I think out of 1 to 7, they give them like the average like a 3
right.
or something like that.
Right.
But there was a correlation between how the men danced and the personality that the men had that was attractive or not attractive. So we have signals, like I was saying before, that we don't even know about. There are certain elements that are our personalities that will come out overtly and covertly in just our movements and how we interpret music, maybe, how we interpret dance. You know, and how we smile or shake hands or whatever it is. And again, like I said, this is just the tip of the iceberg of the research that's coming out.
You come back around to bonding in the book and to Gretchen, mm-hmm. your beloved dog who mm-hmm. you had to put down. And really, I'd say you come to this conclusion that bond is love.
Mm-hmm.
here's how you put it. It is the biological need to cooperate that eventually leads to the poetry.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. We've got this fundamental tension. We've got this evolutionary need to cooperate and to collaborate. We also have this evolutionary need, survival of the fittest, simultaneously. How can both of those things exist in the same space? And it led to a development of some lubricant, essentially. You know, what's going to smooth that transition? What's going to allow us to flip back and forth between cooperating and then being our own dominant self? And it makes sense that it's something like love. It's that emotion that you're going to open up that allows you to love a brother in a foxhole, love a spouse, reach out, love an animal, love a farm animal, care for those animals. And if there's one thing that really kind of helps us make that transition, that fundamental tension in biology, it's that particular emotion. And that's the way I see it.
Let me ask you this finally. You ask at the end of the book whether humans can let go of the idea that we are superior and that we don't need any other species. Do you feel like we can let that go?
I hope so. So the good thing about diversity within a human society or a human endeavor is that allows variability and allows us to do things we otherwise wouldn't be able to do. I extend that same reasoning to other species on the planet as well. The more diversity we have, it's not just because it's this wonderful thing, this feel-good thing. The more diversity in interaction we have with these other species makes us better too. And that's the point I'm trying to make there. We should pay attention to that. There's biological reasons why we want to have all these other species interact with them.
John Shivick, his book is called Mousy Cats and Sheepish Coyotes, The Science of Animal Personalities. John, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.